This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. If the problem is unbridled capitalism, unregulated markets, recessionary spirals, and corporate greed run amok, the solution in the minds of many, including many on the left, is Keynesianism. That term derives, of course, from the name of the influential British economist John Maynard Keynes, born in 1883. Keynes's name is variously associated with the New Deal, with government spending on public works, with deficit spending and tax and spend policies. But what's the truth? Who was John Maynard Keynes, and what did he really say and write? Was he a liberal or a progressive, or was he further to the left than that? And to what extent is Keynesianism, as popularly understood, an accurate reflection of Keynes's actual beliefs? Peter Clark claims that Keynes has often been misunderstood not only by his opponents, but also by those who claimed to be his true adherents. Clark, formerly a professor of modern history at the University of Cambridge, has a new book out. It's called Keynes, The Rise, Fall, and Return of the 20th Century's Most Influential Economist. When I recently spoke with Peter Clark on tape for broadcast today, I began by asking whether Keynes, while attending the University of Cambridge, actually studied economics.
No, Keynes never did study economics, and it came as a great surprise, I think, to Ronald Reagan when he was president, that this man Keynes, as he called him, didn't even have a degree in economics. But when John Maynard Keynes, going to his father's old university, settled on what he should study for his degree, it was mathematics. And he did his first degree specializing entirely in mathematics. And it was really only after that that he got interested in economics, or at least interested enough to give it his serious attention.
You're right that Keynes never settled for simply becoming an economist in a rigorous professional or academic sense. What did Keynes believe an economist needed to be familiar with other than economics?
Oh, a whole load of things. I think you've got to remember that at Cambridge University in his day, the economics tripos, as they call it, had only just been set up, and previously it had been part of another tripos called moral sciences, or philosophy, as it's been renamed today. But that idea of moral sciences is, I think, quite important. So, yes, philosophy is important to an economist. Mathematics is, but an economist should be able to do the math without having to reduce the whole subject to mathematics. History was important, and the study of present politics. What else? I don't know. A bit of psychology, I think, but it's that sort of mix of a number of humanistic disciplines that make the good economist, said Keynes, an easy subject, he said, at which, however, very few excel.
At Cambridge, John Maynard Keynes became involved in a group called the Apostles. Tell us a little bit about the Apostles and about how some of them went on to form a network called Bloomsbury.
The Apostles was a group that had been meeting since the early 19th century, but by the time Keynes got involved with it at the beginning of the 20th century, it had a very distinctive style. Many of the undergraduates he met in this self-elected group were homosexual. Keynes himself had several homosexual relationships. It was a group, not so much an academic seminar, an informal group of both students and faculty or dons at Cambridge who would meet on a Saturday evening and discuss generally great moral questions, philosophical questions, what is the nature of the good life, that sort of thing. And it's interesting that although it's so very much a male-dominated group, very few of them are actually misogynists in an era where women still didn't have the vote. In Britain, many of them were ardent supporters of women's suffrage. When Keynes relocated to the district of London called Bloomsbury and formed that circle of friends, which we know as the Bloomsbury Group, he was really taking the style of the Apostles into the metropolis and into a society that included women too. And the idea that anything goes in discussion, anything can be talked about, matters concerning sex and morality were all grist to the mill. This was all part of the Bloomsbury ethos, along with its aesthetic and literary ambitions.
And some of the other members of the Bloomsbury group were whom?
The members of Bloomsbury originally, just before and during the First World War, not many more than a dozen. The writer Lytton Strachey, who rocketed to fame when he published his book Eminent Victorians, detecting the feet of clay of four great Victorian heroes. E.M. Forster, who already had a following as a novelist, Where Angels Fear to Tread, Howards End, had already been published. Leonard Woolf, who was one of Keynes's very closest friends lifelong, a literary and political figure who, of course, married Virginia Stephen and gave her the name by which she reached worldwide fame. Virginia Woolf as a novelist, and as I would argue, Virginia Woolf, along with Maynard Keynes, is one of the two absolutely stellar members of the Bloomsbury group. A real touch of genius there.
How close was Keynes to Virginia Woolf?
Closer than you might suspect if you had just been reading a number of the big Bloomsbury biographies that have been published over the last 30 years, a lot of which seem to portray Keynes as though he was, yes, part of Bloomsbury, but somewhere near the fringe, not proper Bloomsbury somehow. As I see it, Maynard Keynes and Virginia Woolf are absolutely at the heart and hub of Bloomsbury. And after Maynard Keynes, rather improbably as it seemed to many of his friends, got married to the Russian ballerina Lydia Lopakova in the 1920s, the Keyneses and the Wolves, as they call them, Virginia and Leonard, often used to spend Christmas together, which in England particularly, I think, is a time of for close family and for true friends to meet. If Virginia Maynard had not been close friends, that would never have happened. When Virginia commits suicide, tragically, in 1941, Maynard Keynes writes to his mother that she and Leonard were our closest friends.
In 1938, Keynes read to his friends a paper called My Early Beliefs. And in that paper, he asserts that apostles like himself had, quote, a religion and no morals, and says that they were immoralists. What did he mean by these statements?
Keynes made the provocative claim that he and his friends among the apostles were immoralists. It's one of those too clever by half remarks that have often been quoted against him, as though it meant that he was just a selfish hedonist, concerned with his own pleasures, and that he accepted no sense of public responsibility or public duty. What, in fact, he was saying to a group of close friends who could be expected to understand the intricacies of this because they were drawing on common experience, was that he accepted a view of morality and of following rules, but not of following them invariably. He was asserting a right to conscience in saying that a general rule, which might be commendable in itself, could on certain occasions be broken if you judged for yourself that greater good would result from that action. He was thus, in a way, staking out a ground on which acts of conscience might then be taken.
And certainly, people's consciences in Britain were engaged by World War I. And I want to talk about the question of the British military during that war. The British tradition was that of a professional army plus voluntary enlistment in wartime. How did Keynes feel about military service and about proposals for mandatory conscription into the military?
It's rather difficult for us to recapture the intensity of feeling about conscription into the military or the draft in American terms that existed at the time of the First World War. The British tradition was so much that of a volunteer army to supplement the regulars in time of warfare that it was highlighted as a real cliff face of a breach in practice when conscription was proposed. Some people, of course, argued that conscription was the German method, the Prussian method. That was what we were fighting. We would have surrendered to it, they said, if we allowed the state to conscript us in this way. Keynes's own position is quite complicated. Many of his friends object to the war itself, object to serving in it, and take a stand against conscription in that way. Keynes takes a more complicated position. He says, I might be prepared to volunteer myself, but that must be my decision. I'm not prepared to leave it to the state, and therefore I object to conscription, really, as a method rather than in itself. And he did so, it must be said, from a rather comfortable position, since he was working for the Treasury in London at the time. He was absolutely indispensable to the Treasury, and he knew that the Treasury would never allow him to join up personally in any case.
In 1919, Keynes was sent as part of the British delegation to the Paris Peace Conference. There were, naturally, demands that Germany pay war reparations. What did Keynes think of this?
Keynes thought it was a bad idea to exact heavy reparations from Germany. Partly this was just a matter of politics. He thought that at the end of such a disastrous war, no one country should be saddled with the whole burden here, and that this wasn't the path to international reconciliation. But his basic argument, which it seems to me has never been effectively refuted, is that exacting reparations would be disastrous specifically in an economic sense, because it wasn't as though you could march into Germany and seize a pile of gold from them and just take it home. If Germany was supposed to be paying to the victorious Allies, it would have to be by sending goods across the frontiers as exports, which the victors wouldn't have to pay for. Now, when you think about it, this is a very implausible model if it's going to involve very large-scale transfers. Are the Germans going to carry on working in this way merely in order to get nothing for their pains? And even if they do so, is it a good idea for an industrial country like Britain to watch Germany pile up such a huge export surplus by dominating the markets of Europe that its own exports will be shut out in the process? Keynes is simply pointing out that the economic consequences of enforcing a policy like this haven't been thought through.
Let's talk about unemployment, which seemed to be one of Keynes's obsessions. In 1924, an article by Keynes entitled, "Does Unemployment Need a Drastic Remedy?" was published. How high had unemployment in Britain become by that time, and what remedy did he suggest?
Throughout the 1920s, unemployment was over a million in Britain, which would be roughly 10% as we measure it today. And that was about double the pre-war, pre-1914 level. What Keynes was concerned with was how Britain could not eliminate unemployment altogether, but get back to what he regarded as a normal or acceptable level, say 5%. And when, by the mid-1920s, 6 or 7 years after the war has ended, unemployment is still at these high levels in Britain, Keynes, although generally orthodox in his economic theory at that time, takes the view simply that something has to be done, that the drastic remedy of invoking state action must be resorted to here. And what he's saying, and it's the beginning, really, of an agenda that we can recognize as Keynesian, is to say that under these extreme circumstances, it falls to government to intervene to provide a stimulus to the economy. A jolt or an acceleration is how he describes it, and that'll kickstart the economy out of the slump that it's in.
Peter Clark joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. He is formerly a professor of modern history at the University of Cambridge. And we're talking about his new book, Keynes, The Rise, Fall, and Return of the 20th Century's Most Influential Economist, published by Bloomsbury Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Okay, so this stimulus, this government intervention in the form of some kind of investment, did Keynes at that point specify what that investment ought to be in?
Not very closely, but building roads was a prime example. As the 1920s went on, the proposals became refined. Keynes started working with Lloyd George, who was leader of the Liberal Party, a man whom he'd criticized very severely for his part in the Versailles Peace Treaty at the end of the First World War, but they both of them bury the hatchet. The Liberal Party comes up with a more refined policy that says you can commit sums that now seem to us quite small, like £200 million, to a road-building program, and by doing so, you will lift the whole economy.
How opposed was economic orthodoxy at that time in Britain? How opposed was it to government intervention into the workings of the free market?
In theory, it was completely opposed. The orthodox theory said the economy will always right itself if only prices are left to find their own level, if only prices are sufficiently flexible. And prices, of course, here include the price of labor, that is to say wages. If only wages can be reduced to an appropriate level or by an appropriate amount, unemployment can be eliminated. But in practice, many economists who believe that to be true in theory were nonetheless ready to think along lines quite similar to Keynes and to say, in the position we're actually in the real world, we seem to be stuck. Wages seem to be sticky. We can't sit on our hands in this situation. Maybe we have to reach for second-best solutions. And that's really what Keynes is doing at this point. Long before he makes a fundamental breakthrough in theory, he's prepared to reach out in a pragmatic way for measures that will alleviate a real-world situation.
There's much talk in your book, Keynes, about the importance, the relative salience of savings and investment. What did Keynes see as the real motor of economic growth, as what created the wealth of nations?
I think when we talk about saving and investment, we're getting very near to the heart of the intellectual revolution that Keynes brought about. A younger disciple of Keynes, James Mead, who later became a Nobel laureate, and to the end of his life, an ardent supporter of Keynes, liked to say that Keynes's intellectual revolution was to move from a model of the economy where a dog called savings wags its tail labeled investment to a model of the economy, the Keynesian model, where a dog called investment wags its tail called savings. And I think once you've understood that rather simple image, you're an awful long way to seeing what Keynes was really on about. Because for Keynes, it's not savings. It's not the traditional virtues of thrift that are all important in making the economy go. It's investment. It's the boldness of entrepreneurs in actually getting out and doing things. Bricks and mortar is a way he concretely describes it here. It's the activity of investment that is the motor of the economy and that generates the growth out of which the savings then materialize. So he's really putting the cart before the horse or the horse before the cart as compared with the traditional economic model.
So if Keynes saw public works spending by government as creating jobs and thereby reducing unemployment, How concretely did Keynes see that as helping the economy in a kind of a net way, a net effect?
That's a very good question, because if Keynes had simply been saying that, in hard times, we ought to put the unemployed to work building roads, it would almost have been an extension of a traditional attitude of philanthropy or charity in just making work in a purely artificial way as a humanitarian measure. I'm not saying that such motives were entirely absent, but what Keynes is saying is rather more important than that, because Keynes is saying that doing this will create a stimulus for the whole economy. It's not until the 1930s that he has the right sort of language to describe that convincingly, when he can start talking about a multiplier effect. Because if you put men to work building roads in the simplest model, the money won't just stop there. That will go in wages. Those wages will be spent. Most of them will be spent. And what they're spent on will be supporting all the businesses in the community with whom those men who are now at work are trading, the shopkeepers and everyone down the line. And they too will benefit from this increasing flow of money that's been put into the system, and they will be passing on some of the spending in turn. That is the multiplier effect. This means that whatever you put in as the initial stimulus won't simply stop there. It will have this dynamic effect in getting the great heavy flywheel of the economy turning round again.
Well, couldn't one stimulate investment by entrepreneurs by simply setting low interest rates and thereby making it easy for would-be entrepreneurs or existing entrepreneurs to borrow money such that they could invest it in capital goods and get the economy going that way?
That's a very nice idea, and it's one that Keynes thought was absolutely central for a long time. He said that if only you could have cheap money, meaning low interest rates, that would do the trick. And he thought that in Britain, the gold standard, which meant that you had to have higher interest rates to protect an artificially high value for the pound sterling, he thought that the gold standard was responsible for the fact that Britain didn't have sufficiently low interest rates, and therefore it was responsible for prolonging the slump. But when Britain went off gold, there was still a problem. So the real world problem posed itself to Keynes in a different way. He began to question whether sufficiently low interest rates in themselves, cheap money in itself, was enough necessarily to stimulate the economy. Clearly it was a helpful, a permissive condition, but would it do the trick? And it's at this point that Keynes starts using the metaphor which perhaps explains his conception of monetary policy most graphically. He said monetary policy is very good at restraining a boom. You can pull on it like a piece of string, but at the bottom of a slump, you can't push a piece of string. You can create the opportunities, but maybe however easy credit conditions are, however cheap money is, if entrepreneurs don't have the confidence, they still won't be investing, and you'll still be stuck where you are.
And we could bring the discussion forward for a moment to the present, when, in fact, under times of low interest rates, lenders were not, in fact, willing to lend money. They were very tight with their money, so low interest rates does not necessarily mean that the loans actually go out. Is that fair to say?
That's a key point, that it's not just a question of entrepreneurs borrowing for investment or being prepared to gamble on making a bigger return than the prevailing interest rate. It's also a question of the psychology of investors. When interest rates are rock bottom, perhaps it simply won't seem worthwhile to people with savings to put them at risk in the market. Perhaps they'd rather have the security of just hanging on to the cash, of just shoving it under the mattress, especially in a time of deflation when money values might be appreciating from year to year. This is a very great problem. Yet another problem in the line of thinking that says you can simply rely on monetary policy or upon easy money or low interest rates to get out of a slump. No, says Keynes, you have to administer a more direct stimulus than that.
Peter Clark is author most recently of Keynes, The Rise, Fall, and Return of the 20th Century's Most Influential Economist. We have a link to that book on againstthegrain.org. He is the author of many other books, including The Last Thousand Days of the British Empire and The Keynesian Revolution in the Making, 1924 to 1936. We'll take a short break and return more with Peter Clark talking about John Maynard Keynes. Please stay with us.